Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. For 20 years, environmental activists and the U.S. Navy have been embroiled in a battle over the military's use of sonar and its potentially deadly effects on whales. Last year, the Navy announced plans to increase sonar testing over 5 years off of the coasts of California and Hawaii. The Navy estimates that its activities could inadvertently kill 341 whales and dolphins and injure 13,000. It also predicts marine mammals might change their behavior, such as swimming in a different direction, in 27 million instances. Now, these numbers are directly from the U.S. Navy. In response, the National Resources Defense Council and Earth Justice have sued the Navy, and the fight to save the whales continues. Joshua Horwitz, author of the new book War of the Whales, says, "You never truly win a conservation battle. The best you can do is win the right to fight another day." In War of the Whales, Joshua Horwitz tells the story of environmental attorney Joel Reynolds and marine biologist Ken Balcom, and their crusade to expose the truth about the Navy's submarine surveillance system, which floods entire ocean basins with high-intensity sound. He focuses on a mass stranding of 17 whales in the Bahamas in early 2000. Similar strandings have occurred in the Canary Islands, Greece, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Hawaii, and other sites around the globe, including most recently last April, involving U.S., Greek, and Israeli navies in the Mediterranean. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about the state of the whales, what dangers are they still facing, and who is fighting to help them. Joshua Horwitz is a science and environmental writer. He spent 7 years researching this book. He's also publisher of Living Planet Books. They specialize in books by thought leaders in science, medicine, and psychology. And he joins us from the Christian Monitor Studios in Washington. Hi, Joshua. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me on.
Do we have Joshua?
Yes, I'm right here.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you. And wow, what an incredible book. It almost reads like a thriller. I'm sure you've heard that many times.
Well, that's what originally drew me to the story. It really has all the ingredients of a real life thriller, mystery story. And I've tried to tell it that way because it's really one of those stranger than truth stories, but it's all nonfiction.
Well, and you spent 7 years on this book. You didn't expect to spend that much time. And you write that had I grasped at the outset the depth of my ignorance concerning whales, submarines, the Navy, the ocean, and the law, I never would have dared embark on this project. And it all started in Baja. There's a great video on your website, and we've got that at yourcallradio.org. You went to the last pristine gray whale lagoon with your 13-year-old daughter, and you had some amazing experiences with whales. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I'd initially actually gone to speak to Joel Reynolds, who I knew was going to be there that week, and also had an instrumental role as an NRDC attorney in keeping that whale nursery pristine and save it from industrial development by Mitsubishi and the Mexican government. So I was there as a bat mitzvah present for my 13-year-old daughter, and it's a really unique environment because it's the one place in the world where wild whales come. These are gray whales that migrate along the coast all the way up to the Bering Sea every summer and then every winter back to their calving grounds in Baja. And this is the last lagoon left that's really undisturbed by development and industrialization. And the opportunity there in a very controlled setting, because they only let a few boats in, is to go out on small boats and into this lagoon. And incredibly, the mothers and their young calves will actually approach you almost the way a dog or a cat who knew you would, and seem to invite caresses and certainly, you know, contact. And it's remarkable because you really can have a close encounter with whales unlike any other wild environment. And it does change the way you think about them and feel about them after that experience.
Yeah, and I really hope you all have a chance to check out the video because it's really amazing to see the whales so close up. What was that experience like for you?
Well, I really had a lay person's, you know, ignorance about most things whale and oceanic, and even though I had been an environmental writer and and publisher for a while, and I knew the legal case connected to this story, but I had never actually been out, certainly at close range, watching whales. And it was, I think it was something about being with my daughter and watching this mother and her calf have this interaction and having my own interactions over a period of days. It really change the way you feel. You see how vulnerable they are and how at odds they are with our common images of them. I grew up on Moby Dick and, you know, envisioned sperm whales as these ferocious, you know, aggressive animals. And in fact, you know, people now swim with sperm whales, and researchers are swimming alongside them in very docile settings. It's incredible.
Well, and I love the fact that you open your book with some history. You talk about the fact that whales have ruled the world's ocean for 40 million years, and they owe their success to a weapon that sets them apart from other predators, and that's by sonar, using beams of sound to hunt and navigate in the dark ocean depths. And then, of course, we came along 160,000 years ago. And what's really interesting is, you know, you started doing research about the history of the Navy's involvement with whales. And in the 1950s, they discovered this secret. So talk about how you kind of went down this path, and how did the Navy reveal or, you know, figure this out in the 1950s?
Well, my initial tie into this story was just the legal case, which I had been following as it wended its way through the courts. And this was NRDC, Joel Reynolds at NRDC and Los Angeles office had sued the Navy and had been in court for quite a while over the use of sonar in marine habitats. And, you know, that was an interesting story as far as it went, but it wasn't really until I dove deeper into the Navy's 50-year history of researching whales and training whales that I really got hooked on the story. And it really goes back to the Navy. I mean, it's hard to imagine now, particularly in California, but, you know, back in the 1950s, nobody really cared about saving the whales, mm-hmm. except for whalers, which were desperately trying to figure out how to revive whaling stocks so they could go back to full-throated whaling. But the Navy had noticed that during World War II, a young biology student had, for the first time, figured out that bats echolocate in the air the same way radar works. And bats used ultrasonic sound waves that hadn't been we'd never heard before until we had electronics to hear supersonic sound. And that same scientist speculated that other mammals that navigate and hunt in the dark, specifically whales, might use this same biotechnology, if you will. And so the Navy sent its best scientists, who were not whale scientists at the time because there was no whale science. The Navy, it turns out, created marine mammalogy, whale science as we know it, cetology, out of whole cloth. There really was no predecessor. So they sent bioacousticians and neurologists down to Marineland, which was the first aquatic park in America. It was down in St. Augustine, Florida. It's still there. And where they were displaying dolphins for the first time, and mm-hmm. Americans were just falling in love with these adorable, playful, trainable animals. And they also noticed that they were phonating, meaning they were making a lot of noise in the tank. And so through a series of experiments, the Navy was able to confirm that, in fact, these animals do navigate, and they obviously are communicating with each other with sound, but they were also using sound waves to bounce off of objects to navigate and hunt. They didn't have to hunt in these tanks because they were fed dead fish, but they were able to see that in the wild soon that they were also hunting. And it turned out that their sonar capabilities were, not surprisingly, because they had evolved over tens of millions of years, but they had just so outmatched what the Navy had been able to come up with over, you know, half a century of technology development with their own sonar systems, that they became really obsessed or fixated on the idea of reverse engineering this biosonar for their own technology.
I want to talk to you later in the show about dolphins, but since you brought up Marineland, what year was that when dolphins first performed tricks for the public?
Marineland was actually started in the 30s as a studio lot, if you will, to shoot underwater movie, you know, to be an underwater movie set. And it was in, I think, later, not until the 40s, that it was Creature of the Black Lagoon was shot there and whatnot. And then it was closed during the war, and then it reopened as a marine park for the public. Mm-hmm. And it was an immediate hit, and these were just mostly dolphins, drawn from local waters, and people had never seen them before. Certainly, they'd seen them in the water, but they hadn't seen them at this range and hadn't interacted with them and hadn't watched them in this not natural environment.
Right.
This was the precursor to SeaWorld, but it was, and they were an immediate hit. They were on TV. There was a TV show very quickly featuring them, a weekly, the carnival, the Marineland Carnival show and whatnot. Hmm.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk to you about that because, unfortunately, the slaughter in Taiji, Japan, begins on September 1st.
Yeah.
But let's talk more about the Navy's connection to whales and other mammals. Talk a little bit about how the Navy trained underwater life to perform tasks such as ship and harbor protection, mine detection and clearance, and equipment recovery. They were deployed in the Vietnam War and the Iraq War in 2003.
Right. Well, I was interested in really kind of getting to primary sources on this because most people have heard about the Navy dolphins or the militarized dolphins, but this whole history, because it faded in and out of classified programs, was really swathed in rumor and mythology, and I really wanted to get to some primary sources. So fortunately, one of the Sam Ridgway, who's one of the originators of that Navy program all the way going back to 1961, is still there in Point Lomo, San Diego, and I was able to meet with him. And more importantly, John Hall, who was one of the person who actually trained these dolphins in what was called swimmer interdiction, which is to patrol harbors in Vietnam and keep enemy swimmers who might plant mines on the ships and in Vietnamese harbors at bay. They also, it turned out, were very adept at minesweeping because they can tell the difference with using their sonar between a decoy mine and a real mine. And typically, an enemy might scatter 100 mines, of which only a few would be live mines, but you still have to clear each one by one. So it turns out these animals could do it in a fraction of the time it took human mine-clearing crews, and from the Navy's point of view, with less risk to sailors. And they also can retrieve objects from the deep ocean. They can find objects buried several feet in the mud at the bottom of the ocean floor. They can tell the difference between aluminum and copper plates and ball bearings of infinitesimal different size. So they really are just remarkably acoustic animals. And again, this is because they live in the dark ocean, have for tens of millions of years, and have evolved in very specialized environments to hunt and navigate.
Below 100 feet, it's basically midnight 24 hours a day.
Yeah, anywhere. Even in the Bahamas or, places where they have crystal clear water, you go down a few hundred feet and it's dark.
Well, thanks to movies like The Cove and Blackfish, we now know how dolphins and other mammals are basically kidnapped from the ocean to be taken to these water parks. But how does the Navy do it?
Well, interestingly, the Navy has a long history with the water parks. I mean, for instance, of course, they did that original research in Marineland. But then, interestingly, a few years later, when they started their own marine mammal research program at Point Magoo in California, they had, first they hired a couple of local fishermen to just capture whales, dolphins for them. And by the way, they didn't just research dolphins. They also trained orcas, pilot whales, beluga whales, all of which were small cetaceans, as well as pinnipeds like sea lions. So in any case, they initially just contracted with local fishermen to collect specimens, but they didn't know how to keep them alive in a tank. So they kept dying on them. So they went to Marineland and recruited the curator, Forrest Wood, who was the curator of sort of the science guy, if you will, at Marineland, to come be the director of their research program, because a lot of what they needed to do was not just keep the dolphins and other small whales alive, but to train them. And who better to teach them how to train these animals than Marineland?
Well, and you write in your book, and this is really interesting, that pretty much all marine scientists have at some point worked with or have been funded by the U.S. Navy.
Well, this is, as I mentioned, there was no field of marine mammalogy prior. Well, it didn't even get named until the late 60s, but until the early 60s when the Navy started recruiting scientists. For instance, Sam Ridgway, who I mentioned, who was a veterinarian, they got him from the Air Force up the road, an Air Force base where he was basically treating sentry dogs, German shepherds. He'd never seen a dolphin in his life. And so he became, over decades, one of the many new experts on marine mammals, but they had people like John Lilly, who was a neurologist out of NIH, who got very involved in most of the communication side of whales, but he consulted to them on their training programs. They drew on zoologists and, as I say, acousticians and bioacousticians and anybody who had any kind of relation to this sort of science. So over the years, the Navy really is the only industry, if you will, or the only interest group that had a compelling desire to understand whale physiology and other aspects of whale behavior. So nobody else was funding this research. So not surprisingly, eventually the National Science Foundation got in on funding. But mostly it's been the Navy and continues to be. So there really aren't, you know, which sets up one of the really fundamental conflict in my book, War of the Whales, is built around the sort of soul of the science community. Hmm. Because when evidence began to emerge that certain kinds of sonar systems appeared to be linked to mass strandings of whales or certain species of whales, they were very reluctant to be drawn into this battle for obvious reasons, not the least of which was that they didn't want to testify against the Navy.
I'm speaking with Joshua Horowitz about his new book, War of the Whales. Joshua is a science and environmental writer, and in his new book, he tells the story of environmental attorney Joel Reynolds and marine biologist Ken Balcom and their crusade to expose the truth about the Navy's submarine surveillance system, which floods entire ocean basins with high-intensity sound. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about how mammals are affected by sonar? We'll actually play a clip in just a couple minutes. And I know that we have a lot of people who love underwater life listening. I mean, especially in Monterey, you're so lucky because I've been seeing the photos of whale watching lately, and it's been so amazing. So what concerns do you have about this? What questions do you have? And if you're part of an organization working to protect whales, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So I wanted to also ask you, Joshua, the Navy says that this program will close in 2017, the program to use dolphins and sea lions, for example, and, you know, deploying them in war, basically, will close in 2017. So what are they doing right now? And do you think that it will end in 2017?
Well, you know, again, this is now going back to 1961, a more than 50-year-old program. So the reason I'm skeptical that it will end is not because the Navy doesn't want it to end. What's happened is that over this year, there have been a couple of tracks of research and training. So we alluded to the training programs, and as you mentioned, they still use these dolphins in the Persian Gulf today. And there's a reason for that, because for decades now, they've been trying to reverse engineer this cetacean biosonar, both for their medium and long range systems, anything they can learn about their sonar for their submarine detection, but also for shorter range tasks like mine clearing and harbor patrol. They've tried to develop and have developed what are essentially dolphin drones. If you look at these, they're called autonomous underwater vehicles. Hmm. And particularly, you know, they look very much like dolphins. They're dolphin-sized. They have fins. They have side-scan sonar. But what they found is when they deploy these dolphin drones, if you will, in battle situations, they only work if there's a totally flat bottom, if there are no underwater eddies or currents or storms going on. They work in very controlled environments. You know, in a tank, they work just fine. And in certain calm ocean environments, they work. But often they don't. So even though they would prefer not to, I mean, they get flack from the environmental and animal rights community. It's expensive and difficult to maintain these animals. I mean, they have about 100, I believe, dolphins still in their program. And, you know, to fly them across the world and to care for them and feed them and whatnot is not as simple as it would be if they could. But, you know, it's not surprising that their technology is lagging behind the animals. Hmm.
Is there any way of knowing if the animals are treated well?
Well, you know, to listen to the Navy and to look at their media on this, the animals are happy to be serving. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I'm sure they're treated well to the degree that the Navy wants them in good health. I'm sure they're very well, you know, they get good veterinary care, and they, you know, are not, I don't think, subject to abuse in a in an active way. I don't think they're trained in abusive ways. However, you know, these are animals who live in the wild, who were captured or now bred, and who are being sent into harm's way and in battle conditions. And I just, you know, you can argue about whether the if it's going to save human sailors' lives, whether that's a useful trade-off. One could debate that. What strikes me as so tragically ironic is that after recruiting, or rather impressing them into service 50 years ago and on ongoing way, that the Navy is not more concerned with the fact that their other sonar technologies are driving relatives of these recruits onto beaches. Hmm. And I think that at the very least, the Navy could, you know, do everything within their power to prevent those kinds of deaths and all of the other non-lethal effects you referred to.
So, yeah, let's jump in and talk about that, because the Supreme Court recently ruled in favor of the Navy and its use of sonar. The Obama administration recently okayed the use of sonar for oil exploration off the East Coast. Before we dive in and talk about what happened on March 15th, 2000 in the Bahamas, just tell us a little bit about how sonar works, and then we'll hear some sound.
So sonar is simply, it's sound and navigation radio. It's basically using sound to light up the water. Think of it like a sonogram. It essentially bounces off an object, and if you have sophisticated enough hearing, you can create a three-dimensional image, not exactly a visual image, but an image in the same way that a blind person would, maybe with touch, of the object. And again, whales and dolphins are very adept at this. The Navy's version is more crude in that they're trying to, again, you know, let's not lose sight of the fact the Navy has a serious mission on their hands, which is to track and detect enemy submarines, which are also lurking in the darkness at various distances, and are armed with, you know, at the time this story begins, it's the middle of the Cold War, and their enemy is the Soviet armada of submarines around the world that are equipped with intercontinental ballistic missiles with nuclear weapons on them. We have the same weaponry, but, you know, that was a serious mission. When the Cold War ended in 89-90, the Navy had certain what they called over-the-horizon sonar systems in development, which meant that they could go great distances using low, high-intensity, low-frequency sound that could, in fact, flood whole ocean basins with sound. So it wasn't a matter of just pinging off of an object and trying to find an individual submarine that might be lurking below you if you're, say, a destroyer or some surface ship, but really submarines that are beyond the horizon, 1,000 miles away. And so, as you can imagine, that requires enormous amounts of acoustic energy. So that's what they were doing, and with the system is low-frequency active sonar, and it's still being deployed, though NRDC was able to greatly limit the scope of its deployment. It's still being deployed in the Western Pacific. And
let's hear,
in a nutshell, what it does.
Yeah, we're going to go to break soon, but let's hear a quick clip of what sonar sounds like, and then we'll hear it also after the break.
And by the way, I think this is mid-frequency sonar.
So that is sound of sonar. I don't think most people have heard this, and it's important to play that. We'll play it again after the clip, and then we'll talk with Joshua about how this affects underwater life. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. If you'd like to join today's conversation, perhaps you have a perspective that you'd like to see added to the discussion, or a question you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-TALK. We also invite you to send an email if you prefer to do that. The email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, the BBC's World Have Your Say here on Local Public Radio. KALW, San Francisco. My Broker Donates can connect you with the most effective agents working in your area and in turn secure part of the agent's fees for local public radio. More information at KALW.org/mybrokerdonates.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will be discussing coverage of what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri. We'll also talk about Mexico, which has become one of the most dangerous countries for journalists. We'll be joined by St. Louis American's Chris King and the Dallas Morning News' Alfredo Corchado. And then next week, we are putting shows together about how photography can impact the struggle for human rights around the globe. There's a great exhibit you should check out at UC Berkeley. That's on Monday. We'll also talk about what students and parents need to know to protect themselves from student debt. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, I'm speaking with Joshua Horwitz about his new book, War of the Whales. It tells the story of environmental attorney Joel Reynolds and marine biologist Ken Balcom and their crusade to expose the truth about the Navy's submarine surveillance system, which floods entire ocean basins with high-intensity sound. Joshua is a science and environmental writer and is publisher of Living Planet Books. We have a call about sonar, but before we do that, we just heard the piercing sound before the break. How often is the Navy using this sound today?
Well, if I'm not mistaken, you were playing a recording of mid-frequency active sonar, which is the main tactical sonar weapon system on virtually every warship in the fleet. So every frigate, destroyer, cruiser has hull-mounted transmitters that transmit at more or less that frequency. Or there are variations, but that sounded like mid-frequency, probably broadcasting at 235 decibels at the source, which is very, very loud. Hmm. And, you know, as you saw, I mean, if you played a very brief clip, if you played it much longer, everybody would turn off the radio. And
right.
I do have the same problem when I speak in public and play a recording. I have to keep it to 5 or 10 seconds or I'd have people running out the doors. And that's what it sounds like to whales, hmm. but more so because they are so acoustically sensitive.
Well, we have a question about sonar from a listener. Let's go to Nick in Watsonville. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm just a guy who got more movies about Over the Hill Gang Rides Again, where Walter Brennan might be saying, I'd like to give these guys, these whales, a better memory. And the other guy would be saying, well, they need some backup, I tell you. And the other is, and when it comes to offshore testing, it seems to be the riding right through us, because we have a deal out there that says we can't drill. And then in their And the civil disobedience isn't there, because it means shut down the freeways right away to slow this thing down, because the pace is full on. It's going to be happening, and the peace from these whales, that's so
right,
beautiful.
Well,
it's a memory I like to return. I want to give them the smelly oceans. And
thank you for calling in. Can you talk about the laws that regulate this?
Well, the story really emerges in the fact that there were laws on the book going back to the 1972, most specifically the Marine Mammal Protection Act, but that was the same time period that the Environmental Protection Act, the NEPA, the Coastal Management Zone Management Act, all these laws were passed to protect endangered marine mammals and marine habitats. And the Navy, during the Cold War, which again ran all the way up to 1990, never bothered to acknowledge or do any of the things these laws require, which is essentially to get a waiver. If you're doing anything this noisy or that's going to harass or harm marine mammals, you need to get a permit from the Fisheries Department. And it was really Joel Reynolds at Natural Resources Defense Council who in the mid-'90s, 1994, 1995, sort of stumbled on the fact that the Navy was getting ready to deploy this very high-intensity, low-frequency active system that they had been testing at sea for almost a decade without any observance of the laws. So he was really, that was his basic strategy, which is drag the Navy into court and make them accountable to the law, which they had no, at the time, no exemption from. And what he lacked was the physical evidence trail that emerged in the Bahamas in 2000.
We have an email from Carol who says, what is the point of designating a marine park around the Hawaiian Islands, for example, as a sanctuary if the U.S. Navy can blast their sonar anywhere they please?
Yeah, I think what she's referring to is that the, as people may remember, for about 2 months ago, President Obama extended the Remote Islands National Monument, including, I think, Bush had set one up around the Western Hawaiian Islands and in the Marianas and in these remote islands in the South Pacific. And Obama essentially doubled the size of the sanctuary as a sanctuary from commercial fishing and mineral and energy exploration and extraction. However, you know, historically, there's been a carve-out in these preserves for military activity, most specifically Navy war games or testing or activities, exercises. So, you know, this is a comment period, and I would prompt people that if you want to submit a public comment on this summer, I think at least through sometime in September is a public comment period where the public can comment on this new national monument in the Pacific, and you should sign in and, you know, register your both with the White House. Really has an I would go to the White House Office of Environmental Affairs, because, you know, they're the ones who really will ultimately rule on that.
And we'll put a link about that at our website, yourcallradio.org. Speaking of the White House, last month the administration announced plans to reopen the Eastern Seaboard to offshore oil and gas exploration. And the AP reports this is the first real step toward what could be a transformation in coastal states. This hasn't happened in decades. So what are your thoughts on this announcement? Why would they do this?
Well, you know, we seem to be, I think it's a combination of foreign affairs events in the Middle East and just, you know, the economic drivers. But this is a classic example of the oil interests versus environmental interests. On the East Coast, they happen to overlap with new Navy ranges or new activities on naval ranges in that same strip, which is from Orlando all the way up to the Delaware Bay. And there had been a 30-year moratorium on oil exploration in those waters, and it elapsed, and the Obama administration and Congress allowed it to elapse. It had been around for 30 years, first as a congressional and later as an executive order, and, you know, it's just... I think it's very short-sighted, because if the economics don't really add up, because in addition to marine mammals, such as the Atlantic right whale, which migrates through those waters and is very endangered, you have all the fisheries there, which are going to take a huge hit if you have all these air guns firing day in and day out, night and day. And also tourism. I mean, there are a lot of economic interests beyond oil and the jobs that might come from oil extraction, because there is oil there. I don't think there's any doubt there's oil. The question is, you know, at what cost?
Well, and how do they find it by using sound? The AP reports that the cannons create noise pollution in the waters, sending sound waves many times louder than a jet engine, reverberating through the deep every 10 seconds for weeks at a time. And the U.S. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management acknowledges that thousands of sea creatures will be harmed, even as it approved opening the outer continental shelf from Delaware to Florida for exploration.
Yeah. Yeah, well, these are called air guns, and they are, you know, guns or cannons, whichever you want to call them. They fire highly compressed air really, it's the loudest industrial sound in the ocean. It's about the sound. It's as if you fired a .357 Magnum by your ear.
Wow.
At the source. And the problem is it's firing straight down. The idea is it goes through the water, through the whole water column, and then into the crust. I mean, the sound energy penetrates the crust and to discover oil reserves and, you know, pools below the surface, so they'll know where to drill. And the problem is that they aren't just doing this in one place or at one time. They're crisscrossing whole areas that they're exploring and just pounding it every 6 to 10 seconds with these air guns. And it goes on and on and on. For as long as they need to kind of map the whole floor. And these are very fragile marine environments for marine mammals and all marine life that lives there.
Joshua Horwitz is out with a new book, War of the Whales, and we will talk about the story he tells in his book. Environmental attorney Joel Reynolds and marine biologist Ken Balcom get together to expose the truth about the Navy's submarine surveillance system, which floods entire ocean basins with high-intensity sound. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about sonar and how it affects whales, if you work to save the whales, I know so many of you are lucky to live in the Santa Cruz, Monterey area where you're seeing a ton of whales. Actually, we're seeing them up here, too. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255 if you work with any organization that works to raise awareness about this issue. What changes have you seen, and what do you think needs to be done about this? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Lindia in Santa Cruz. Hi, Lindia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having this issue on your show. It's such an important one, and especially for us who live here in the Bay and see these magnificent creatures and know that they're actually even in a marine sanctuary, not protected from sonar sound. So I would just like to first of all say that the book is excellent, and it really gives people a grounding in what's going on. Even if you have no interest in sonar, it's a very wonderful adventure story. Mm-hmm. And our organization, which is whaleanddolphinwatch.org, we actually have a petition up currently to ask the president to call the Navy into line to follow the environmental laws that are already in place, and specifically to keep the sonar sound out of the migratory routes of whales. So thank you so much for having me on.
All right. Well, thank you so much, and thank you for the important work that you do. Joshua, let's talk about the story you focus on in your book, March 15th, 2000. There was a whale researcher, Ken Balcom, who's been studying beaked whales in the Bahamas for 10 years, and on his, in his front yard, he found one stranded beaked whale, which is very rare. And these beaked whales look like dolphins. They're not well known because they spend so much time underwater. But what happened when he found that whale?
Well, this is where the story gets so intriguing from a narrative point of view, because Ken Balcom, who, as you said, had been studying these whales for a decade, had been studying orcas up in the Northwest every summer for 30 years by then, had really kind of dwelled in the shadows of marine mammal research. He was a field researcher who sat out on the water for hours at a time waiting for one of these. These are the deepest diving animals in the world. They live in the deepest underwater canyon in the world. It's about three times the breadth and depth of the Grand Canyon. And these whales, there are some species of whales that do commonly strand alive, like pilot whales and sometimes dolphins, but beaked whales never do, or certainly in his long experience, he had never seen a live stranded whale. And that day, literally on his back doorstep, a whale comes ashore in the shallows. And again, these animals live in these deep canyons offshore, and the shallows are run for about a mile along the coast, and then it plunges into this canyon where they never leave this canyon. They've been there for tens of millions of years. And as he was working to push this animal back out to sea in the direction of the canyon, he got reports of other strandings down the coast a mile, up the coast 2 miles, on other islands, on out islands. And what's remarkable is that he knew, aside from being one of the probably two specialists in the world on this species or these species of beaked whales, he also had a secret history with the Navy. And so he knew who to call at the Office of Naval Research and get an investigation going, because he saw the signs. He also had a background in marine acoustics with the Navy, so he saw the signs of what looked to him like it could well be an acoustic trauma, because of the patterns of bleeding. I mean, these whales had, you know, they don't look good when they get to the beach. They're already in deep trouble, and he suspected that there was an acoustic event. He didn't know if the Navy was involved, but he immediately set about figuring it out.
And by the end of the day, 17 were stranded?
17 whales of three different species, which at the time was the largest mass stranding of multi-species mass stranding of whales ever recorded. And you know, what he did that really made the difference, because, you know, honestly, though a lot of well-meaning people work very hard to get stranded whales back out to sea, particularly in shark-infested waters like the Bahamas. It's a long shot that any of these animals are really going to survive, because by the time they get to the beach, or their time on the beach is so traumatic, or what drove them there is. But the next day, when there were corpses on the beach, he had the presence of mind to collect specimens and literally cut off heads and drag them into a deep freeze to create a specimen trail.
Yeah, and so the heads had to be transported to Harvard Medical School.
Yeah.
Can you talk about why it's so important to cut off the head, and then what can we learn by studying the head?
Well, it turns out there are many organs that are impacted by acoustic trauma. At the time, the most obvious one to look at, because sometimes these animals are bleeding from the eyes and the ears, and it's clearly they have so many arteries and veins going in and out of the brain, because these deep diving whales have to have a lot of oxygen going to the brain while they're holding their breath for 90 minutes at a time. So they're very venous animals, they're called. So in any case, it stood to reason that they wanted to look at the heads, and also there was a particular whale pathologist who was immediately brought in on the case, who contracted with the Navy out of Woods Hole, Darlene Ketton, who had created this technique of CT scanning using a computerized tomography to look at the inside of a head before you did an actual dissection, so you could get a very good 3D model of what had happened there. And it was a great pathological tool she developed, and it happened to be her machine was up at Harvard, where she taught alongside, as well as at Woods Hole. And so Balcom and his wife and research partner, Diane Claridge, had to literally transport two of the freshest heads in cardboard boxes wrapped in duct tape that were out of the freezer, and race them by regular aircraft, rather, you know, first to Miami and then up to Harvard and get them to the lab before they defrosted. So had a sort of Keystone Cops aspect in certain times.
Is it possible to separate the frequencies the Navy uses and those that affect the whales so greatly?
Well, different whales hear at different wavelengths, the same way we have a certain, you know, we hear in certain wavelengths and frequencies, and so do whales. So these whales have certain frequencies, and, you know, the Navy is looking at this because one of the byproducts of, I mean, one of the ongoing truths is that all we know about whales has to do with, you know, flows from Navy-funded research. And lately, in the wake of a series of court cases, they had to devote more energy to research into this area specifically and try to come up with technological solutions. But they've been elusive. I mean, the fact of the matter is, this is very noisy sound, and it's used massively. It's not, I mean, the Bahamas was an entire battle group sweeping through a canyon at midnight, you know, with sweeping sonars and omnidirectional and unidirectional sonars going for 12 hours, filling this canyon with high-intensity sound. So tweaking the wavelengths or the frequencies isn't likely to make a difference in that environment.
Is there any way of knowing how many whales and dolphins and other marine life have been affected by the sonar? Because as you write, the only way for us to know is when a whale, for example, is stranded. What the other thing that happens is that obviously they die and they just sink to the bottom of the ocean, and we never know in that instance.
Yeah, I think it's worth pointing out, the Navy often points to the relatively small number in the dozens or hundreds of whales that have been, you know, you can attribute their death on a beach to sonar. The fact is, it follows to reason that most of the whales that die or are grievously injured are either taken by sharks or because they're leaving their safe, normal habitat and trying to swim to shore, which is fraught, or sink when they die, which most whales do. Mm-hmm. So in the Bahamas, there's a 3-mile deep canyon, and it's unknowable how many whales are at the bottom of that canyon. You know, but it's really less, to me, a numbers game than it is, you know, just there's a moral imperative here, particularly when we're deploying them in battlefield environments alongside our own sailors, I think, to do what we can to protect them in these environments and respect their environments, their habitats.
Joshua Horowitz is an environmental writer and author of the new book, War of the Whales. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Eileen in Mountain View. Hi, Eileen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My concern is that all of these things relate to people's feelings, and California needs 2 million gallons of gas and oil per hour, so people have this feeling that they need their oil and gas, and at the same time, they don't understand how much they need the whales. And so I'm wondering if there's some way to approach this, and maybe your book does this, in a way that people understand that that we're all in this together. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, that does cut to the core of it. I mean, the parallel issue is national security, because that's the Navy issue, is that they feel, well, we need to train for sonar, and we need to train in environments we're going to have to fight. And so the question is, what are the limits of our need for oil, our need for national security, or, you know, to what degree do those override our appreciation, kinship with, however you want to qualify or quantify the value and worth of marine mammals and whales. And, you know, all I can say is there's no way. One of the really fascinating parts of my book, the story in my book, is that the original whale, the Navy scientists who were studying whales, the ones they recruited to this effort, several of them became the fathers, if you will, of the Save the Whales movement, because once they had worked with these animals up close and spent time with them, they could no longer just see them as research subjects. Mm. And I think that, you know, what I take heart from is, you know, you talked about the great whale watching they've been having on the California coast this year, which is probably due to, you know, shifts in foraging habits having to do with climate change. But, you know, the fact that more and more people are actually getting to see these animals, not in marine parks, but in their natural environment, and get a sense of the splendor and majesty and whatever adjectives you want to assign to this, and have their own direct experience of them. I think the more people do that, and the more people get actively involved, I really want to highlight what Lyndia's story mentioned when she called in. I mean, you know, her petition, which is a moveon.org petition, and on her website, is, you know, a way everybody can make their voice heard, because she's, I you know, gather, also delivering her petitions and making sure they get to their intended audience. And I think that, you know, everybody does have to, it's not enough to go look at whales and admire them. You do have to get involved.
Are state officials standing up to this? Because last year, the California Coastal Commission voted unanimously against the Navy's 5-year plan to increase sonar. And, I mean, this is a huge victory for environmentalists and people who work on these issues.
Well, it's interesting you should raise that, because my understanding is that the Coastal Commission has asked the Attorney General of California to sue the Navy over their violations of the fact that Navy went ahead in defiance of the Coastal Commission's finding. And for reasons that aren't clear, because I think it's been at the Attorney General's office and a complaint has been drafted, but for some reason the Attorney General has not filed that complaint. And I'd be interested to hear from their office why that is the case, because the Coastal Commission made it plain, you know, what their ruling and judgment was, and the Navy acted in direct defiance of that. So I'd be interested to hear from that.
Yeah, well,
Attorney General.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely look into that. Well, thank you again for calling in, Eileen. Let's hear from Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill.
Hi. You picking me up?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay.
And we're almost out of time.
I'm wondering, I mean, obviously this goes back to bad policies that affect our need for energy, as well as bad foreign policy that, you know, puts more people in harm's way. You know, do you want to talk about that?
Well, I mean, you know, you could speak to policy. Ultimately, there are individuals who make these decisions, and the reason you know, I honestly, my conclusion at this point is the Navy is not likely to do what's necessary on their own. It has to come from the commander in chief. You know, the Obama says he's going to rule independent of Congress and do what he feels is in the best interest of the country. And I would like to think that he would care enough about our marine habitats and, you know, reflect the concerns of certainly California citizens, or I know how passionately you all feel about your coastlines and the marine mammals who live there.
Yeah.
That and on the East Coast that you know, he would direct the Navy and the Secretary of the Navy, who reports to him, to find alternatives to sonar exercises in marine habitats. And that's what NRDC has been asking for 20 years. And I think it's not too much to ask.
I understand the Navy has not responded to you or your book. Is that still,
well, I did
right?
get a I got a very good review in Navy Proceedings, which is their lead magazine. So I was very pleased that an environmental security professor at the Annapolis Academy, the Naval Academy, gave me a very good review. But that's the closest I've gotten to a direct reaction from the Navy.
Just quickly, also, what is an alternative? What would that look like?
Well, I mean, you know, the Air Force has been used simulators for training. This is all about training for sonar. Mm-hmm. This is not about using it in war or battle situations. And the fact is that other, you know, the Air Force has used simulators for decades, and the Navy uses simulators too. And to the degree that they can simulate these environments and train using simulators, that would spare a lot of habitats the insult of all of this noise and noise pollution from all sources, whether it's oil and gas drilling, shipping, naval sonar, are really drowning marine life, particularly along our coastal areas.
We've got about 30 seconds left. I just wonder, since you spent 7 years of your life reporting on this book and, you know, really trying to raise awareness about what whales and other marine life are dealing with, are you hopeful? Because when you look at Blackfish and the Cove, I mean, there's so much awareness now. SeaWorld stock just took its biggest dive in history last week. Huge investors are pulling out. And, you know, people on social media are talking about what's happening to whales and dolphins and orcas like never before.
Yeah.
So do you see a major
shift? Well,
it's
because people, I think that happened because people voted with their feet, you know, and people stopped going to SeaWorld and entertainers stopped appearing. You know, the Navy is actually very sensitive to public opinion. Mm-hmm. And I think if the degree to which people can make their voices heard, whether it's through petitions, writing letters, emails, whatever they can do, what other groups, whether it's NRDC or Earth Justice or Whale and Dolphin Watch, whoever they can ally with and join their voices, I think they can have an impact. I believe that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Joshua, and thank you for writing this book.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank you. Joshua Horwitz is author of War of the Whales, and be sure to check out the videos at yourcallradio.org. And thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the latest in Ferguson, Missouri. The ongoing protests continue to receive global attention, so who's asking the right questions and taking fresh angles? We'll also talk about Mexico, which has become one of the most dangerous countries for journalists. We'll be joined by the St. Louis American's Chris King and the Dallas Morning News' Alfredo Corchado. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Hey, this is Jad Abumrad from Radiolab. So what do you do when you want to make something new in the world, but you don't quite know how and you're paralyzed with the thought that it might suck?
Well, October 1st at 7:30 p.m., I'll be coming to Norse Theater in San Francisco.
We'll talk about that, Radiolab, radio innovation, much more.
That's October 1st, 7:30 p.m., presented by City Arts and Lectures. So for info and tickets, check out cityarts.net.
CityArts.net. Job Abumrad coming to the Norse Theater here in San Francisco. Ticket information, CityArts.net. World Have Your Say from the BBC is coming up next. The program was recorded an hour ago for broadcast. At this time, it's 11 o'clock, and this is 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco, a listener-supported community broadcast service. We're online at KALW.org.